Hi guys, I'm Joe Katz. Welcome to The Katz Walk. I am so excited today to have Tone Bell, actor, stand-up comedian extraordinaire. He is going to share with you some of his exciting stories of starting in stand-up comedy and then landing his key role in The United States versus Billie Holiday. Check it out. Tone Bell's in the house. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. Doing great. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Well, thank you so much for joining my show. I have so much to ask you. I saw your special on Amazon, which was great.
Yeah, man. Appreciate it.
I did some research.
I appreciate you doing a little bit of research.
Yes. I gotta know a little bit more about Tone, but, and we want to talk about, United States versus Billie Holiday. That was fabulous.
Thank you. Yeah, man, that was a different one, but I loved it. Yeah.
That was really, really interesting. We'll get more into that too. But I want to just start out, you know, I always, you know, here I am with my bow tie because I'm a stylist. So I'm into fashion and I style people and I do everything with fashion. But I like to know a little bit more about, like, you know, everybody talks about the roles you've done and da-da-da-da-da, but I like to know a little bit more about, like, who you are. Like, who is Tone Bell? And, like, how did you grow up? And where did you come from? And I'd like to just know a little bit more about your life. So I just wanted to know, growing up, where did you grow up?
I grew up just outside of Atlanta. That's where I'm from, Atlanta, Georgia, just southeast Stone Mountain, Decatur, Georgia. About 15, 20 minutes outside the city. But I kind of grew up all over. I spent majority of, like, the school year in Atlanta, and then every summer I'd get shipped off to, you know, extended family in St. Louis or Chicago. And so I've been kind of, like, bouncing back and forth basically kind of, like, my whole life. So but, like, I guess my formative years were mostly Atlanta.
And what was life like growing up? Did you grow up like in just a normal kind of family? Was it just very everyday, like, white picket fence?
Not a lot of white picket fences, but yeah, mom and dad still together. They're from St. Louis originally. And then kind of every few years, I would say things got better, you know, from an apartment to a small, you know, lower class and then lower middle class. And then, you know, by the time I was in probably high school, midway through high school was lower middle class, or I would say probably middle class by then. And then by the time I went to college, luckily I got a scholarship. So parents were, like, breathing a little easier. And so, you know, now they're comfortable. But I mean, it was, you know, just kind of like the struggle, two parents hustling. They both have two jobs growing up. Really? I grew up kind of in that, I mean, definitely suburban, but not like gated community. Still saw a lot of, you know, crazy shit growing up. I wouldn't say I was too overprotected, but I saw a lot growing up. I mean, you know, my buddy James Davis has a joke called hood adjacent, but so I guess I was pretty hood adjacent. I mean, as much as I didn't live in the shit, I was across the street from it, and just being a teenager, just got in, you know, some trouble here and there, and just, you know, probably trying to be something I wasn't, but kind of get into performing arts in high school and, you know, took theater classes, not at really the theater school, but started doing sketch comedy with this kind of like group that was associated with my high school that I went to. I ended up going to a shitty private high school, actually. But also, you know, on the other side of being a black teenager in Atlanta, I mean, you know, I've been to the parties and had to run from gunfire and seen people get jumped and people get shot and all that kind of stuff. So, like, I mean, it's a wide array of, I guess, childhood, you know. So then went to college in Savannah and graduated 2004 from Savannah State. Then kind of hopped around, went to San Francisco for an ad agency job, taught first grade before I did that, and worked for Anheuser-Busch for about 7 years, corporate, moonlighting, doing comedy at night. Did a small stint of corporate work in Miami, New Orleans, and then I spent the most time in Dallas, is where I got my comedy career started. And then kind of when I realized sales and marketing wasn't for me, and I fell in love with stand-up, and then 2011 moved to LA.
Wow, what a background. I heard all, because I watched your special and you were talking about going to work for Anheuser-Busch, and I want to get into that because it's interesting that, like, you go from that to this and where you are today is awesome. But when you say you saw a lot of things, because I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Iowa, and then I moved to Minneapolis and New York and LA. And, you know, I've seen so many different things, and we all go through different things. But when you say, was it like dangerous in your neighborhood or not really?
No, no. I would say by the time I was in junior high school, kind of like the eighth, ninth grade, I guess when I was 13, 14, I think our neighborhood was pretty, I mean, that's probably the most diverse neighborhood. And my parents still live in that house. But I would say we had very few, I would say white neighbors or diverse neighbors. It was probably predominantly black neighborhood or whatever. But I mean, very nice neighborhood. And then by the time I got to high school, junior high school, it was like probably a lot of, I guess like the only white neighbors I had were probably old as fuck. they were all super old. But I mean, it was a good neighborhood of just like a nice working class, like black community. But I wouldn't even call it a neighborhood. I guess it was kind of it was more of a suburb, but it wasn't like a, you know, you drive into a neighborhood with like a sign in front of, this is, you know, Wilshire Downs or some shit like that. It wasn't like, didn't have like a label of the neighborhood.
Right. But it was just a neighborhood.
It was just a neighborhood. Yeah. But everybody, you know, took care of their house. You know what I mean? It was dope. It was definitely like a different feeling of that neighborhood from 12, 13, 14, from 5, 6 years before that, because it was a little different. You know, I would say that was a little more dangerous, but like, you don't know, as a kid, you know, you don't know what you see. You just see your neighbors, but you know, your mom's like, hey, I need to be able to see you. Whereas by the time I was 12, 13, it was like the neighborhood was a little more, I don't know if it was safer. It was just, I think you could trust it a little more. And she didn't mind, you know, it's like, you know, we know the neighbors now, and like, and you know, your friends down the street, their parents do what we do, and they want to see the best for us. So, yeah, I mean, but by that time, you know, I was, you know, cutting grass in the summer a week after, and the weekends playing baseball and soccer and basketball. So like, yeah, I mean, I definitely watched the levels, you know, as a kid of my parents do better and want more. And I mean, I was never the kid that had like Jordans growing up. It was always, you know, I mean, I remember when Fila's came out and I wanted some and they were $100 and my mom got me Ocean Pacifics and I was like, I cannot.
Oh.
High tech boots were a big deal, name brand, everything. And we weren't there yet, but I was like, I can't wear this to school. I mean, my classmates would ruin you. I mean, it's happened plenty of times, right. But it was just, you know, it was in that era of what are you wearing? What do you have on? You know, I mean, I would look up friends down the street who, my parents were probably doing better, but you know, they spent money on throw pillows and curtains. And so, you know, we looked like we were doing better, but the clothes were just, it's like, man, I can't keep up. You know, I was borrowing clothes and like, hey man, if you're not wearing this jacket, can I wear this starter jacket? So I remember my mom in fifth grade got me I think it was called a pro starter. Starter jackets were huge. And I got a pro starter and it was like, I used to cuff the sleeve back so you didn't see that I didn't have the starter logo.
Oh, right. You had the pro starter.
I had a pro starter and it was like everybody else had the zip up, but I had like the pullover with the big pocket in the front and it was embarrassing.
All the things we go through because I remember like Calvin Klein jeans, but I'm a little older than you, but that was like the whole thing in fashion and everybody had to have certain things. Did you go through things like you got involved with groups that maybe weren't as good or you kind of stayed away from that stuff?
No, not really. I mean, like my group of friends were, I would say at best mischievous. I mean, like by the time we got to high school and I started, you know, getting jealous of what I didn't have, it was work and pay for it. But I mean, we did a lot of stealing.
Oh, a lot of stealing.
Yeah, we go to Macy's, Marshall's and TJ Maxx and stuff. And if we didn't steal it, we would change the price tags, right?
Oh, so the like, tickets.
Yeah, we would change the price tag. So we would take like, you know, like the yellow and red clearance tag. So we'd take like a $4, you know, if you could peel it off, we'd walk around the store, act like we were looking, and then we'd put it on like a Tommy Hilfiger jacket. And so we'd get up to the register and be like, man, this jacket's only $8. We're like, I know, that's why I had to get it. I mean, so we like, we put a clearance tag over something that was like 50, 60 bucks, but so it was stealing, but we still paid for it.
Yeah, you paid for it.
But it was like, if they put the sticker on better, I wouldn't be able to peel it up.
Oh.
So it was like, we switched stickers and stuff. And like if we wanted a wallet, we just take all our stuff from our pocket, put it in a wallet and then use that wallet to take our money out to pay for something else. But meantime, we're still in the wallet too.
You were smart. You were good doing it. Wow.
I mean, yeah, we had some schemes back in the day. Yeah, it was, not always the best kid, but never did anything like, violent. It was just more just like, hey, man, I got to keep up.
Yeah, yeah. Was there that vibe in your neighborhood, the violent stuff, or not as much?
I mean, we would go to the, some parties and stuff, and it'd be fights and stuff, and not all the time, but occasionally, you see that.
Just normal. Yeah.
And then kids hanging out and older kids come in and we'd be hanging out off Memorial Drive or something at like a teen party or whatever. And, you hear gunshots, I think when I was in Chicago, I saw my first gunfight when I was 12.
Oh my God. Are you scared of that? Or are you like, cause you don't seem like that, that
tough,
that kind that's like, look, I'm going to mess you up. Like you seem like a nice guy.
I've never been afraid of a fight, but luckily I haven't had to get into a lot of them. I used to work at my aunt's in the summer. I would go, my aunt had a store in the city off of Huntington Cottage Grove in Chicago, kind of like right across the street from the projects. So she had a little corner store and she owned like this little strip mall, like a hairdresser, dry cleaner. And she had like a little, very tiny little grocery store and just, neighborhood store. And a kid that she helped raise, I saw him every summer. I think by this time he's probably, I don't know, early 20s. He has a daughter and he was getting into, this is back when you had to take, you remember when the radios had the face you could pop off?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it was like kind of that 90s era.
Yeah.
Of when you leave the car.
Oh, you take that off. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I was working the register at like 12 and I'm giving out cigarettes and lottery tickets, all this kind of stuff.
Oh.
I'm selling that kind of stuff. And then these two, I'm not gonna say names, but these two guys came in and I guess they were fighting over a girl. First time I've seen it. And one dude pulled a gun on this other dude and he put his, kind of pushes his daughter like, hey, go over there. And he didn't have a weapon on him. So he just grabbed grabbed a bottle of barbecue sauce and they were about to have it out in like right in front of the register in the store. And my aunt came down the steps after seeing it and just was like, I raised both of y'all. If y'all want to kill each other, go outside. But it was, I've seen a lot of close calls and I've seen, I've been in a car that's been jacked. I think the craziest one was, I was probably 5-6 feet away. Me and my buddy Dominic were probably 5-6 feet away from a dude that was shot at a gas station after a party one night. And you just hear gunshots and we're like, you just run. Right. I mean, this is pre-cell phone. Just had to figure out where we parked and everything. And then afterwards we're like, man, you can't be shooting at a gas station. That shit's super dangerous. You start thinking about the,
oh my God.
But I mean, I would say those are very rare occurrences. I've seen a lot of stuff, but, my best friend now from high school, he runs Magic City, famous strip club in Atlanta, but we grew up together. And I mean, it actually took me till last year to realize like I was one of the only dudes in my crew that had a dad there all the time. I mean, between, some dads not being around and in prison or, we were in 10th grade, my buddy's dad got murdered right across the street from our school. It was crazy. I mean, so I've seen a lot of shit, but also didn't know, never really thought back about it till I had a year of contemplating last year. You know what I mean? So start looking through life and you see all that kind of stuff and you go, wow, man, a lot of dark days, but a lot of light days too.
Wow. You have a lot of interesting friends. One's that owns a strip club too.
Yeah.
Free access to
a lot of we went a lot of different ways, a lot of different industries.
Yes. You got entertainment, they got strip club, they get everything. You cover all the base. It's like you seem like this very kind of clean cut guy. It's interesting to hear your background. So it's like, I like to understand, what people
are
doing.
Often and it's not, I guess I don't think about it because I guess, my friends and I from high school and college, we all still talk and everybody's doing better than how we came up. And I think that's every generation's idea, right? It's like everybody's parents want you to do better than they did. So it's, I mean, just being around it and seeing it, and not being involved in it so much, but also it's right around the corner,
Right.
But yeah, I do hear that a lot of like, oh, it didn't seem like you, I mean, even though I went to a private school, it was not a good one. It was a very shitty private school. I mean, they're shut down now. I mean, there's so many scandals and all this. Like, if you ever look that up, if you look up Chapel Hill Harvester, oh man, the headlines that you will read. I mean, it's
really
very culty. It was wild. Like, lucky I didn't get too enthralled in it. It was different. It was very different.
Wow. What was school? Were you like a popular kid growing up?
High school, I went to such a small high school that everybody was popular.
Yeah. I mean, what about grade school? Were you a popular kid?
No, I was probably in the middle. I wasn't like a lame kid, but I wasn't like the popular kid. I kind of was in the middle. I mean, I was funny, but I wasn't stylish. And girls didn't like me, but didn't dislike me. You know what I mean? So it was like,
right.
You know, I think I probably came into my own of like, you know, having like a little bit of swag, probably my junior and senior year of high school.
Of high school.
And then, cause like I got kicked out of, I didn't get invited back my junior year. And so my senior year, I had to go to a different school. And that's kind of like, I came from a different school. So that was different of like, oh, and that's high school was small. My graduating class was seven.
Seven people.
Seven. I think it was the first year for a high school. This very small private school.
Well, it sounds very fancy that you're at a private school, but you know.
It was shitty. I mean, wonderful people, right. Wonderful people. Like I would say, you know, right. All the teachers and the principal or the headmaster, everybody was great, but it just was like, it's like you ever go to a restaurant, you're like, this shouldn't be open.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like, that's the way. Like the food is probably great, but there's no way that y'all passed the inspection. It was kind of like that. Now I'm thinking about it, I think that's kind of one reason my parents weren't worried about me returning to the school I was at because it was some accreditation shit going on. And I think the senior class before me, a lot of people didn't get into college because like they didn't have the right credit. So they had to wait a year. So yeah, it was like, oh, you're getting out of here anyway. And then I had to go to a different high school that allowed me to get the right credits for college. Yeah.
Right. Oh, wow. So then you went on to college and then you, from college, you became a teacher?
So yeah, I graduated 2004 and then I taught first grade for a year after college. Cause I was 20, I was turning 21 that summer and I didn't know what I was going to do. And it was like, go back to Atlanta like everybody else and go. I was like, I did not want to go live at home.
Yeah.
I don't want to go back to my parents' house. So I kind of stayed in Savannah for a year, and worked as I started off as like a permanent sub and then kind of took two classes and did a year. And then I'll feel shitty about this, but right before, I want to say it was April, maybe early May, I auditioned for the HBO film Warm Springs with Cynthia Nixon and had like a very small part in that, but I quit like Hollywood call. I was like, I'm not coming back.
Hold on, this is when you were a teacher.
Yeah.
Oh, and you got the part.
Yeah. It didn't end up making it. So I went to Rome, Georgia and shot for like 2 days, end up on the cutting room floor. And I want to say it was Cynthia Nixon and that was so long ago. I forget the other actor's name, but it was HBO original film. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, okay, great. I'm out. Hollywood called. And then I was, you know, trying to audition for like small parts, but I was working for this lady who did real estate and I was doing all her copy. I could write back then and I was doing Photoshop and all that kind of stuff. So I was doing all her, you know, mailers and, you know, email blasts, all that kind of stuff. And then through that, I kind of got this advertising gig with Swivel Media in San Francisco. So I moved out, I moved out west.
And so then you decided I'm not, because sometimes you think if you go into something like teaching or substituting, like, you know, before you know it, you just get caught up and 10 years go by and you're still a teacher, you know, but you were able to kind of move out of that.
I just know, well, one, it was, I don't know if I were in Atlanta, what would have happened or a different city, what would have happened? But I know in Savannah was like 70,000 at the time. Like the city's that big and it's just, for college, it was just small enough and just big enough to go, oh, I can have fun here, but I don't know if I want to like live here. So just trying to figure myself out after a year after that was great. It was great. I had a little small house. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a little small house. It was like, I think 2 bedrooms. I mean, what was it like? Man, it might have been like 750 square feet. Old school house, great big porch out front and nice little backyard, detached garage. I think I paid like $600 a month for this house.
Oh, wow.
It was amazing.
And then you gave it up because you got this gig in San Francisco.
Well, no, I went back to Atlanta for a little bit, probably just shy of a year. Mm-hmm. And then I got this job and went to training in Chicago and then moved to the West Coast for the gig. Yeah. And did that just for about a year. Went back to Atlanta for 6 months, started doing the promotion job, the one I mentioned in my special. And then I kind of got tapped by someone at Anheuser-Busch, and they were like, hey, do you have a resume? You have a degree? And literally probably a few weeks, maybe a month after that, got a phone call and had a one phone interview and then moved on to corporate from the agency.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so then you did that for like 7 years.
Yeah. So I got about, I would say 4 promotions over 7 years. And so they kept me down in Miami for a few months. I was traveling a lot. It's almost like a paid internship when you first get in, right? So they give you like this fun job of like traveling, doing events and kind of just learning the company and all the perks to make you go, oh, I want to do this forever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I mean, kind of, you know, almost like a paid to party thing. You right. know, I mean, you're still doing reports and learning, you know, your you know, what's on your dashboard and your KPIs and your ROIs and all this kind of stuff. And it was great. It was great. I mean, the culture, you know, a lot of fun friends, and I met a lot of people. And I mean, even to this day, I mean, people that I work with, they still come out to shows. I mean, a lot of my corporate friends who still work for the company, if I'm in that town, then they'll come out. But yeah, it was great.
Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. They are able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcast.
So then how did you decide, you know what, I'm going to leave this and I'm going to try stand up.
I got to Dallas 07, like fall 07. And by January 08, I decided I wanted to entertain. I wanted to perform, but having a corporate gig, it's not like they weren't shooting a lot of stuff in Texas at the time. You know, I mean, it wasn't a lot of TV and mm-hmm. auditions and stuff like that. I mean, there might've been 2 agents that I remember.
Okay.
And, yeah. And it was like, but I had a need to perform, and I just wanted to express myself. And it was like, I think the easiest thing for me to do to at least get that out of my system was stand up. Mm-hmm. And it's a selfish thing, because if it works, I get all the credit. But if it doesn't work, I didn't waste anybody else's time.
Right. But stand up isn't easy just to like step in and be like, hey, I'm going to be a stand up, you know?
Right. But I'm also in a city where nobody really knows me.
Oh, okay.
So if it doesn't go well, I lose nothing.
I see.
I don't know if I would have started in Atlanta just because like I'm from there and I know so many people there.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would have done it. But yeah, it was great. I mean, the community there was probably 8 clubs when I started, and then a lot of spots around town. Then I had a company car, which, oh, I mean, I had free gas to just drive to every show. So, I mean, as a comic, I've never really struggled because I had a day gig. I mean, you know, I'm going 8 to 6, 8 to 7 with clients and stuff. And then I'd leave at 7:30, go hit the open mic. And then hopefully, you know, 6 months after that, I'm doing kind of book shows. And 6 months after that, I'm doing like small towns and, you know, featuring for friends. And so that happened from, I think, top of 08 through 11. Top of 11, I was dating a girl, wasn't working out. She kind of moved from Florida to Texas to be with me. And then she didn't get the career and she had no ambition. So it was like, you got to go. And so as I'm driving, I was like driving her back to Florida uh-huh. in her car. Uh-huh. I was like, I told her parents, yo, she coming home.
Okay.
And, while I think we had just crossed the Texas Louisiana border and got a call like, hey, you're being laid off. And I was like, oh, thank God. I was like, I've been trying to get laid off for like 2 years.
Yay.
Like, it was like, wow. It was like a reverse affirmative action. It was like, I could not get fired. Being like one of the only black people in this department out of hundreds, I could not get fired. I was trying to get laid off.
You wanted to.
Yeah, I wanted my severance so I could like focus on comedy.
Oh.
And then they finally gave me a layoff and I was like, I'll take it. And they're like, bring your computer and your car back. And I was like, I'm handling some other business right now, but when I'm back on Monday, I will bring you, I'll buy one of those I just got fired brown boxes and I will bring everything back. And then they offered me a promotion with a crazy salary jump. I mean, I think it was probably a 40 grand salary jump. But I would have to travel about 90%. And I was like, this is going to ruin this dream of doing stand-up. Like, I think I'm getting really good at this. And I said no to that. So that's April 2011. And then by August 2011, I moved out to LA.
Wow. So you turned down, they offered you $40,000 increase. And they said, we're laying you off. Then they said, no, wait, we're going to hire you and give you $40,000 more.
Right. So HR called me and then a different department called and said, hey, you know, just, which apparently happened. You know, I mean, we went through at one point, I think this was a year prior, I think in 2010, they had a cattle call layoff. It was wild. We were at a conference and then everybody with this position had to go into a room one at a time and figure out if you're getting laid off or a promotion. And I beat that one.
Wow.
And it was like, bring your stuff in, probably 100 of us.
Yeah.
And then you go in one at a time, you know, your time slot, and they let you know if you're going to keep a job or, you know, if you're going to move, if you're going to get transferred or something. And then it's like being on a football roster, you know, like a football team.
Right, if you're chosen.
And then you just get cut.
Right.
And then I made that cut. I mean, I probably bypassed about two or three cuts and then got to, I didn't want to be I think the role was
corporate account manager.
No, it was a K. It was a K.
Okay.
I forgot what the fuck that stood for. But I did not want to be a cam.
Yeah.
I did not want to be a cam. I mean, I think my range was like I was 28 years old. And it would have paid me between like 91 and 110 or something like that was the range. And I was, you know, great money for my age.
Right.
But it's like, I'm not a beer guy. I'm not a sales guy.
Right.
You know?
Wow. So then you said no to that job. They laid you off. They brought you back, said $40,000. You said no to that. And then, but you were making enough to just kind of keep yourself going doing stand up.
I mean, I had a nice nest egg, but I wasn't. I wasn't really making money off comedy.
Right.
I mean, I was making gas money off comedy.
Yeah.
But luckily I had, you know, all those years built up of gas money and, you know, corporate cards. So I could get dinner. I mean, I guess clients really supported my career. My biggest clients were 7-Eleven and Circle K. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were like, you know, a lot of black people, a lot of people of color, a lot of immigrants and everything, you know, who started a business. So people were like, hey man, if you want to live this dream, hey man, invite us out. We'll bring the whole family out. And very, very, very supportive.
That's cool.
Very supportive.
Wow.
And it was like, I could invite them before I could invite my coworkers because my boss hated it. Dude, my boss hated it. I mean, he was like, you can't have two jobs. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? This is a hobby. I'm just doing this on the weekends. Like, you go fishing on the weekends.
Do you think he was jealous?
I don't know. I mean, he looked like Ron White.
Or just corporate-y.
Like, he just jealous. I don't know if it was jealous, but it definitely, I don't think he wanted to see me thrive at it. Like, I feel like he just kind of had that, like, hey, your time is mine during the week.
Right.
And it was, you know, I remember him saying something like, hey man, you work for me. I was like, I kind of look at it like we work together. You know what I mean? It's we work for the same company. You don't sign my checks. And then he actually said that one time. He was like, who do you think signs your checks? And I was like,
not you.
Motherfucker, not you. Like, you don't sign my checks. You might approve it, but you don't sign that shit.
You ain't signing it.
One time we were at a Jimmy Buffett concert because we sponsored Jimmy, and he was hammered. His wife apologized so many times, but he made me do stand up at a tailgate party while he was fucked up. And it was so embarrassing.
And you did it?
That's when he was like, I'll sign your checks, you're gonna do some stand up.
Oh, and so you did it.
And I was like, I'm not even dirty, but I was like, I did the dirtiest set I could think of because kids were around and I'm like, he's being a dick. And I'm just going, I mean, I did all kind of finger blasting jokes and just blowjob and shit that I don't even do.
Right.
And then they cut me off like 3 minutes in. And I was like, yeah, that's what you get for putting me on.
That's right. You're like,
so I never invited any shows and stuff. Yeah. And they tried to reach out in the last couple of years, but I'm very petty on. I'm like, if you didn't support me, then you can't support me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm very like, I don't forgive shit like that.
Yeah.
I hold a good grudge.
I mean, it's kind of, that was not a cool thing for him to do, you know?
I got a feeling like even now, like he, you know, if he sees me on something or his wife sees me on something, he's like, yeah, you know, he used to work for me. And I just knowing he says shit like that.
He's mine.
Oh, fuck. I couldn't
he's
stand
still
it.
Mine.
I couldn't stand it.
Yeah, yeah. Did you always want to do comedy and acting? Was that always the thing?
Yeah. I'm a huge Will Smith fan. So actually, like I said, last year I did a lot of self-discovery, but I just, for some reason, because of the I think the theme of Fresh Prince really resonated with me. So I always felt like Will Smith, just like family sending him out of town to like have a better life, you know? And, and so I really attached to that idea. And, I was like, I'm going to do what he's doing. And I mean, I got, you know, life is happening how it happens. So like I've done the sitcoms and the, and wanting to do that thing. I mean, my mom asked me what I wanted to do when I was 12. And I go, I want to do what Will Smith's doing. She was like, so you want to be on TV? At first, she was like, well, you want to be like a news reporter or something? I was like, no, I want to do that. What are you talking about? And she was like, okay, we don't know how to do that. And it was, I mean, she's the only reason why I went to college. I was going to just come straight to LA when I was 18. And she was like, if nothing else, just do me a favor. Give me 4 years. Go to college. Graduate. Then you can do whatever you want. And we made that agreement. And then after that, I did my 4 years and then I figured out how to squeeze my way into Hollywood.
But you know, a lot of people go into stand-up. I mean, I see it here in LA, you see it, I'm sure, that are in the clubs, very funny, very talented, super talented, but they don't, it's that next step. Like what, how do you get there? Like, you know, you see so many people and some do, some get on great shows and, you know, all that stuff. But there are just some that are at the Comedy Store, the Laugh Factory, whatever they are. Those are the clubs here in LA that like, what do you think? Where's that jump that took you to that next level?
Man, I had a very different path. It's hard when you know, because as soon as you book something or get noticed for something, you know, people who are peers or striving for the same thing ask you how you did it or your advice or whatever. And it's very difficult for me to give advice because I do think my experience is just very different. Another comedian and I, Mark Agee, we moved out here and became roommates, like I said, August 2011. And by September, I had booked like 2 national commercials, right? So, I mean, I had no agent. I kind of crashed these auditions. And then the end of that month, I end up doing this NBC. It was, back then, it was called Stand Up for Diversity. Now it's called Stand Up NBC.
Yeah.
And so I end up doing that. I did it 4 years in a row. I did it from 08 to 2011. Every year got closer and closer. And then I kind of figured like I cracked the formula of what they're looking for and how to be in the top 10. Because I didn't want to win, but I did want to be in the top 10.
So you did it every year.
Yeah. So I traveled every year to you know, just chip away at this. I mean, a bunch of people that I respected and had great careers at the time and still do had come through that program. And I didn't know how to break in. It's like, all right, it's a lot of white guys to sift through and a lot of great black comics to sift through and great, wonderful black actors to sift through. But like, how do I get noticed? And that got me noticed by NBC. And so after November, December, I had a deal with NBC to be signed in January. I hadn't even been in town 6 months.
Wow.
So I had a holding deal with NBC for the next year. And then within 10 months, I'm a series regular on Whitney on NBC. I mean, I hadn't been in town a year and I'm a lead on a show. So that was just very, it was like, people like, how did you, I'm like, I don't know. I played my cards right. But it also, I mean, I was sleeping on an air mattress, really just stacking, you know, saving money. We lived in a very shitty apartment, like very, very, very high in the valley. And me and Mark did. Yeah. And luckily, we never had to get jobs. You know, like I didn't have to be a waiter or a valet or you know, go find another. I actually got offered a couple jobs in the beverage industry. And I was like, they're at night. And I'm like, if I need my nights during the day, I might think about it, but I need my nights. Right. And so I just turned it down. Right. Man, probably went 50, 60 grand in the bank, maybe. And I was like, I should be able, I mean, if I play this right, I should be able to survive at least for like 2 years.
Yeah.
And then stuff, you know, stuff. Cause I mean, I just, you know, I didn't want a lot. I was traveling a lot. So it's not like from all my previous jobs, I was able to save a lot of money and, you know, for my age. And by the time I got out here, it was, this is what this was for.
You know, you said I needed to crack the code with the stand up to diversity. What was that code that you, when you chipped away from 8 08 to 11, you got this one thing, you knew what it was.
Well, I was looking at like who had won previously and like what their story was. So it was kind of like, all right, I need to prove three things in this very short 6-minute set. It was can I be witty enough in 6 minutes to give them a surprise? Like, you know, just doing that 180 in a joke. You think I'm going this direction, but it's going that direction.
Right. And to have a
perspective of who I am and kind of where I come from and just how I observe things. It's like, here's my perspective on the world and life. So this is my angle in humor. And then, can I create another character and do an act out? So can I show you I can write? Can I show you I can act? And can I show you I have a perspective? Like, if I can do those three things in 6 minutes, I should have enough attention to
get their attention.
Yeah, to draw you in to go, I want to see more of him.
Right.
You know, I want to leave you just enough to go, man, I'd watch more of him.
Right. So you cracked the formula of like what to do to get their attention.
Well, and all the guys fans of, you know what I mean? I would see a lot of comics I was really fans of in previous years of this. And so it was like, oh man, I'm a fan of that dude already. And like, they're smart and they can act and also becoming my peers at the same time. And so it was, but also who do I want to be as a comedian? I want to be a storyteller. So it was like, how do I do that to drop these small nuggets on you at the same time, but also want you to want more. So I mean, I guess it worked out in real time.
Hey guys, thanks so much for watching the first episode with Tone Bell. It was so great speaking to him. We have so much more. Actually, we have a second episode, so I want you to tune in. He's talking all about working with Andra Day and Lee Daniels and all about his fashion and style. Make sure to subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app. This has been a production of Evergreen Podcast. A special thank you to executive producer Gerardo Orlando, producer Leah Longbreak, and audio engineer Dave Douglas.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly, and our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.